This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now, here is your host for JAMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will spotlight articles from the October 2020 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. With us again, JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan, and associate editor, Dr. Mallory Brown. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Brown is also a family physician and geriatrician at the University of North Carolina, where she is an associate professor of family medicine and director of the residency training program. Dr. Brown and Sloan, welcome back to JAMDA On The Go.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So today's topics from the October 2020 issue of JAMDA include issues around nutrition, hospital readmissions, and connections between sleep duration and mortality, and I can't wait to talk about that. But Dr. Brown, the October JAMDA issue includes a series of articles on nutrition and cognition, and I understand that we'll be looking at two of them. I want to start with the first one, omega-3, omega-6, and polyunsaturated fat for cognition systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized trials. This is nice to see.
Yeah, I was really excited to see JAMDA publishing work around nutrition. Nutrition is one of those inexpensive ways that I think of as a helpful thing for our patients to really be their best selves. And any work that supports or even negates the potential impact of nutrition is really interesting to me.
Well, I have to share with you and Dr. Sloan and our listeners that my PhD, while it's in pathology, it was focused around nutrition, specifically omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids and their implication in cancer cell growth. And we found some significant changes with regard to omega-3 fatty acids. So it seemed that they actually were extremely important. You know, what were your thoughts around this article on omega-3s being really the it thing still today?
That's fascinating. I will look to hear more about that from you, Wayne, about cancer and omega-3s. Well, in this article, they talk more about that ongoing search for the magic pill. Is fish oil or is a fatty acid supplement going to fix it all? That's not really the gist of this article, but that's sort of one of those questions that my patients are coming in with. Many of my patients and nursing home residents over the years have inquired about the utility of adding on an omega-3 or an omega-6 supplement to their daily regimen to help support their memory or any other number of things that they're hopeful that might be helpful with. This study interested me because it really assessed the effects of increasing omega-3s, omega-6s, or the total polyunsaturated fats on new neurocognitive illness and cognition. It's long been thought that the neurocognitive function might be influenced by polyunsaturated fats, but I've never read anything that really convinced me one way or another. So in this systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials in adults, the effects of higher versus lower omega-3, omega-6, or total polyunsaturated fats were studied. Ultimately, 38 randomized control trials that included nearly 50,000 participants were included. These all had participants on a supplement over at least a 24-week period. Outcomes of new neurocognitive illness, newly impaired cognition, and/or continuous measures of cognition were assessed. Meta-analysis suggested no or very little effect of the long-chain omega-3 supplements on new neurocognitive illness, unfortunately. There wasn't much effect on new cognitive impairment or global cognition assessed using the MMSE either. Even when adjusting for the dose, duration, intervention type, or replacement, no difference in effect was found. That's all in regards to omega-3 supplements. Mm-hmm. The effects of increasing omega-6 or polyunsaturated fatty acids were a bit more unclear. So this extensive trial data set enabled assessments of effects on neurocognitive illness and cognitive decline that were not previously adequately assessed. Long-chain omega-3 probably has little or no effect on neurocognitive outcomes or cognitive impairment. While I certainly wish the outcome of this study were different, I was impressed with the work, and I'm now able to tell my patients with a little more clarity that omega-3s don't necessarily help older adults protect against cognitive decline, so they may want to spend their money and effort on something else to protect their memory.
So as long as you're not invalidating my PhD, I think that's absolutely fine. But I was frankly surprised, especially for those pundits who believe that there is a connection with vascular disease and dementias like Alzheimer's disease. So, and the effects that omega-3s can have, and even omega-9s, which are the olive oil types. So very, very interesting study. Like to switch over to another study around nutrition entitled The Relationship Between Dementia Subtypes and Nutritional Parameters in Older Adults. And for those of us who work primarily with older adults, you know, we're very used to hearing from families about nutritional change. Mom doesn't eat as much as she used to. She often has a plate that's still full of food, or mom likes comfort food only now, and I can't get her to eat, quote, a well-balanced diet. So we know that with dementia and food intake, there may be additional problems. But, you know, with regard to this study, Dr. Brown, what did, you know, was there an effect with nutrition and dementia?
It's a great question. I think a lot, how does nutrition affect my dementia patients? But generally, I spend my time thinking of how to, as you said, ensure that patient is having a well-balanced diet rather than the reverse, I guess. I haven't spent as much time considering how nutritional parameters might differ or be affected according to the subtype of dementia. Interestingly, this cross-sectional study compared the parameters characterizing nutritional status and micronutrient levels according to the different dementia subtypes and did find some subtle differences. So in 440 newly diagnosed patients with dementia, all of which were over the age of 65, they were retrospectively evaluated. They had each undergone a comprehensive geriatric assessment, and the data on this assessment, including their nutritional status, so body mass index, mini nutritional assessment short form, their albumin and micronutrient levels, including vitamin B12, folate, and vitamin D, were all recorded. In the end, 396 patients were included in the study, and of this total, 195 were diagnosed with Alzheimer's type dementia, 70 had dementia with Lewy bodies, 25 with vascular dementia, 51 with frontotemporal dementia, and 55 with normal pressure hydrocephalus. 17% were found to have malnutrition, whereas, perhaps not surprisingly, 43% were at risk for malnutrition. The analysis showed that patients with Lewy body dementia and vascular dementia were actually the most likely to develop malnutrition. Frontotemporal dementia had a lower risk of developing malnutrition, and there was no difference that existed in terms of those micronutrients, so vitamin B12, folate, or vitamin D. Dementia and malnutrition undoubtedly have a close relationship, and I think it's safe to say as a provider, the care team has long acknowledged that this is a potential concern. This article, though, identifies the risk and suggests that clinical approaches to minimize malnutrition in persons with dementia should include regular screening for malnutrition and its risk factors, avoidance of dietary restrictions, and it reminds us that the support of persons at risk might be with oral supplements. The work done here shows us that both dementia with Lewy body and vascular dementia patients may have worse nutritional status. And therefore, when these specific subtypes are identifiable, it may be more important and may require more attention to these details.
You know, I don't think, Dr. Brown, that any, you know, this comes as a surprise to any of us who work with older adults, you know, the connection between dementia and the risk for malnutrition. What I thought was so valuable from this study was that they actually put a number to it. And the number is scary, that 43% really is an impressive number with regard to the risk, isn't it?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the numbers are a little bit staggering and not a little bit, they're pretty staggering. And just really calling out the specific types of dementia that may be more at risk was pretty impactful for me in my future practice.
I was the editor that shepherded this paper along, and having worked a lot with folks with dementia, and I was trying to think, why is this? And to me, Lewy body dementia and vascular dementia are often associated with swallowing problems. Hmm. And so, you know, a potential way to think about it is because of that, they're much more likely not to get as much food in. Hmm. Whereas people with FTD often have hyperphagia and they'll be eating all kinds of sweets and you have to kind of control their diet because they're eating so much and they gain weight. So there really are differences in the dementia and the way it presents that make sense in terms of this data. So I really like this study because it helped validate some of the differences between dementia syndromes.
Two wonderful articles in the October 2020 issue of JAMDA.
Managing your patient's needs across multiple specialties is increasingly important, but also an increasingly challenging task. U.S. Post-Acute Care now offers clinical staffing solutions not only for primary care medicine, but also for behavioral health, chronic care management, and telehealth, bringing you a more comprehensive solution for your patients and your facilities. Now more than ever, your patients need you in so many ways. Let U.S. Post-Acute Care help you deliver more complete, quality care. For more information, visit us at uspostacutecare.com.
I now want to switch to another very interesting and a little bit more challenging article around hospital readmissions reduction program in post-acute care, implications for service delivery and 30-day hospital readmission. I think that many of our listeners are well aware of the hospital readmissions reduction program. It was really put in under a value-based model for looking at how we could better coordinate care and reduce costs or increase cost savings. And there have been some conflicting reports around the benefit of this program. So Dr. Sloan, tell us a little bit about this significant study in the October 2020 issue of JAMDA.
Thanks, Wayne. Well, you know, like many health services research studies, you have to look really hard to figure out if there's any implication for the clinician. But it's an interesting study because of the program that has affected all of us that have anything to do with long-term care. Back in 2012, the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services initiated this program to reduce rehospitalizations. And as is not uncommon with CMS, the program involved a stick rather than a carrot.
Yeah.
It did this by reducing Medicare payments to hospitals that do not meet benchmark 30-day readmission rates based on the previous 3 years of data. Now, the program has been reported by multiple studies to be successful in lowering readmission rates, and we've kind of all seen that. We've worked on it. This study went beyond the hospital setting to look at what happens in nursing homes providing post-acute care. Specifically, the investigators had two questions. First of all, was whether the program changed the frequency with which patients were referred to nursing homes in post-acute care. And the second was whether CMS's practice of selecting target conditions reduced readmission rates just for those conditions or for other conditions too. In other words, whether the program led to generalized changes or just focused attention on some diagnoses and possibly away from others. which of course is something we're always talking about around some of the quality indicators. Anyway, the target conditions that they studied were among the first ones used. They were acute MI, heart failure, and pneumonia. The non-target conditions they studied were ischemic stroke, knee arthroplasty, and hip arthroplasty. Now I would add that these were targeted for later, so I think maybe they weren't necessarily the best choice, but that's what they studied. The authors used Medicare claims to study three time periods, and this was really nice design. One, before the hospital readmissions reduction program was even initiated and introduced, and then one after the act was passed, but before it was implemented, to see if people started doing things already. And then one after the act had been fully implemented. Their statistical analyses adjusted for differences in risk based on age, sex, and comorbidities. Here's a summary of their results. Regarding their first research question, they did see a modest uptick in the rate at which patients were sent to nursing homes for post-acute care, but only for the conditions that were on the list of target conditions. A similar trend was not observed for the non-target conditions. And my interpretation of that is that hospitals saw nursing homes as a way to potentially improve outcomes and therefore started sending some persons with the target conditions to nursing homes that they had previously thought about sending home. The actual numbers are modest, but they suggest that the readmission reduction program was a factor in increasing post-acute care admissions to nursing homes. Regarding the second research question, the study found that readmission rates were reduced for both target conditions and non-target conditions. I find this reassuring because we always wonder whether focusing quality indicators on some and not others will make care worse for the others. So one other thing the study found was that contrary to what hospitals seem to have believed, going to a nursing home for post-acute care had very little impact on readmission rates compared to sending the patient home. Both were associated with reductions in readmission.
You know, Dr. Sloan, I have to tell you that this study resonated with me, given my experience working with accountable care organizations and preferred networks. When we looked at bundling of issues around arthroplasties, stroke, myocardial infarction, and even pneumonia, we didn't tackle CHF. You know, we did find that having folks go to the nursing facility was actually a benefit in helping to reduce the readmission rate. So a study which really confirms what I know. But you know, what's the take-home message for clinicians overall here?
Well, whether you agree or disagree with what CMS does, I found the study encouraging. Basically, to me, it means that if a patient is hospitalized and the attending physician is on the fence regarding sending them home versus a nursing home, we can be reassured that either avenue is likely to produce a similar impact, depending on where the needed care is most feasible and desired by the patient.
Yeah. And once again, it's reminding us that we do have to take the preferences of the patient in mind, because that may play a role as well into how well someone does post-acute care. So wonderful, another wonderful study. For our last study entitled The Role of Cognitive Impairment, Physical Disability and Chronic Conditions in the Association of Sleep Duration with All-Cause Mortality Among Very Old Adults. Sleep, wow. And for those of us who have been dealing with the pandemic, sleep is often a foreign term. And I think there are ongoing questions today about what in fact is the impact of sleep on health. There are companies which are actually marketing measuring sleep in order to make people healthier. But you know, what do we know now, Dr. Sloan?
Well, I have to preface this by saying I'm not a very good sleeper. You know, I never fell asleep in class. You know, after I would deliver a baby, you know, I would be up for hours, you know, I just was never good at just falling asleep. So as a result, I'm not the world's greatest sleeper, and I've thought about it a lot, and there's a lot of studies that you can read about it. JAMD alone has published several papers on the topic. The main questions involve, you know, how important is sleep quality and how long you need to sleep. The paper that I'm going to be discussing now is about length of sleep duration. Now, this is not a new topic. In fact, there's been so much research on the health impact of sleep duration that there have been a whole bunch of systematic reviews summarizing the research. The most recent one I could find, published in the Journal of American Heart Association in 2017, concluded that the sweet spot seemed to be about 7 hours per night, with a 6% increase in risk for each hour less and a 13% risk for each hour above. Now, of course, this was for younger adults. But this indicates that sleep duration indeed, in general, has a U-shaped curve, and that too little or too much is either is bad for you or a proxy for other things that are bad for you.
So I remember quite distinctly in geriatric fellowship, as we're discussing throughout fellowship, normal processes of aging and the differences between older adults and younger adults and the uniqueness of older adults. One thing that was a mantra was that it is a myth that older adults need less sleep than anyone else. We all need to have that sleep. So the older adult who says, I only get 3 to 4 hours of sleep, and that's all I need, that may not be necessarily true. And we also know about the changes that occur in sleep patterns that are part of normal aging in adults. But what does this study in the October 2020 issue of JAMDA add to what we know?
Well, before I go to the paper, I do want to talk about a little bit about reflecting what you said. My colleague, who unfortunately died suddenly and sadly, Dan Coffer, used to talk about sleep as where the brain takes out its trash.
Yeah.
And he basically said, you know, if you don't take out the trash, after a while, things get bad. And so that's kind of the way he thought of it in terms of cognitive function. In terms of physical function, I don't know. But this paper, and the unique feature of it, and the reason we accepted it at JAMDA, is that it studied sleep in very old people. Everybody in the study had to be 85 or older.
Wow.
Also, it was a longitudinal study with a huge sample size, 17,637 participants, who were enrolled and then followed for 10 years. I would add that this study was done in China, and the size and quality of it is an indication of the way in which aging research has really grown up in that country.
Right.
Of course, sleep duration in this study was reported sleep duration, and that's a big caveat. This is reasonable, though, because reported sleep duration in general over large numbers is pretty well correlated with actual sleep duration. And it would be ridiculously expensive to put sleep monitors on so many people. And by the way, if you do it, you've got to monitor them for at least a week to know what kind of the average is. So as has been done in U.S. studies, the investigators asked participants on enrollment how many hours on average they slept every day, including napping, which was the first thing I thought of when you talked about your 3.5 hour a day sleeper, was how much they were napping. Anyway, here are the study's main findings. Number one, as in younger adults, the sweet spot was right around 7 hours, exactly the same. But in this very old population, the sweet spot extended all the way over to up to 9 hours. And it was more sleep was okay all the way up to 9 hours. This is to say that the healthiest sleep duration for persons 85 and older is 7 to 9 hours a day. Now, we also know that older people have to spend more time in bed to get those 7 to 9 hours of sleep because it takes them a while to go to sleep, they wake up, they go to the bathroom, all these kinds of things happen, but in terms of sleep, so they need more time in bed to get the amount of sleep that they need. Unlike younger adults, sleeping a shorter amount did not seem detrimental.
Interesting.
Yeah, sleeping less than 7 hours only resulted in a 3% increase in mortality per hour less. A difference that was so small as to not be statistically significant, even with this huge sample size.
Wow.
Sleeping longer was, however, strongly associated with mortality. And I think I've seen this as people as kind of, as they're kind of in a, particularly in a nursing home setting, as they're kind of nearing the final days, they're sleeping a lot. But even earlier than that, The increase was 13%, and it was significant at 0.0001, less than that. And many clinicians know this. We see that as older persons fail, they sleep longer and longer. Death may be years away, but the extra long sleep pattern is a warning sign.
I thought this study was absolutely fascinating, especially with regard to the last bullet you talked about the longer patterns of sleep. And I have to wonder whether it goes down to the capacity to manage stress, physiologic stress, namely, and that we lose that capacity with aging, and whether that ends up being reflected in much, much longer sleep. And the longer sleep pattern doesn't necessarily cause mortality, but I wonder if it's a herald for mortality. Very, very interesting. Not what I was expecting to see with regard to the effect of less sleep. I was just wondering what, as a geriatrician, what are your thoughts about, in your experience from, looking at this paper and your experience in general, caring for older adults?
Well, it resonates with me. You know, the long sleep resonates, the short sleep, I found it reassuring. When I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, I can't get back to sleep. But still, I think sleep is a good indicator. And as people get more and more frail, energy, the effort they have just to do daily activities really gets reduced to the point where, as you said, sleep gives them an opportunity to not have to deal with the stresses of life for that many hours a day.
So the October 2020 issue of JAMDA is fascinating, as it brings some very common issues, nutrition, and sleep to the forefront, things that we've always been thinking about and now we can read about and learn a little bit more about. Under the leadership of co-editors-in-chief, Drs. Philip Sloan and Cheryl Zimmerman, and with the support of editors like Dr. Mallory Brown, the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association continues to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Take a look at the October 2020 issue. Dr. Sloan and Dr. Brown, thank you again for spending your time with JAMDA on the Go.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
References for this podcast can be found at www.jamda.com. And until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA on the Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.